Hello and welcome to Masters of Our Domain, the podcast that was once about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld and is now about whatever the fuck we feel like. I am Milo Edwards and I'm joined as ever by my intrepid co-hosts Patrick Ryman and Phoebe Roy. How are we doing?
You know what? Even though we've been doing the mood redux for a fair few months now, every time you say that, I panic because it's not the old intro.
Yeah, I do wonder what's coming next. Like that's, but yeah. You know what? I feel like it's good to be kept on the edge of your
seat
right at the start of the show. Yeah. Like this is,
I'm panicking too, Deck, because because also if you want to peek under the hood, I try and say your names in the opposite order every time, so as to disabuse any possible notion that there's an order. But then sometimes I'm halfway through the sentence and I'm like, what order did I say it in last time?
I love knowing that this is what's going through your head as you do this. This makes it so much better.
Yeah, but now I've just realized that the free episodes and the bonus episodes alternate. So anyone on the free feed thinks I say it in the same order every time.
Oh my God.
You should do it in batches. So like five times Wyman, five times me, then like them back.
Yeah, 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 that would make sense. It would
make sense, but would it ruin the spontaneity that we've come to expect and love from the read-in?
That is true.
That's a good point.
This podcast is all about spontaneity, Pat. There's very little that happens on this show that's not spontaneous. I don't know if that comes across to the listener, but...
Speaking of spontaneity, we decided to watch Pirates of the Caribbean.
We fucking did.
We did. We don't have an excuse or an explanation for that, really. It's historical. It's not set now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a fun example of historical fantasy.
Yeah.
That draws inspiration from a specific historical period without being slavish about its adherence to it.
Totally agree. Also, they had pirates in the ancient world. Caesar had an encounter with some pirates.
Yeah. Pompey also had some encounters with pirates, less pleasant than Caesar's.
Yeah. A lot more crucifixion involved. But, you know, that's one way to deal with pirates. Pirates are a bit like mice, you know. There's like, you can use the humane traps, but you're not really going to, you're only really tinkering around the edges of the problem.
Yeah, you got it. You really, what you need is pirate borax, like you use on the ants.
If you catch a pirate, then you need to take them like 5-6 miles away and set them free, because otherwise they will just come back.
I mean, the worst are the pirate glue traps, because then they're just stuck to it, but they're still alive and they're just going like, yar, and you've got to finish him off with a cutlass or something.
It's just cruel, isn't it? It's just cruel. And also,
it would be so funny, the British Empire just putting down glue all around the beaches of Barbados.
Also, if you already got a peg leg, then you just remove it. Wouldn't even work.
That is true. Assuming you went peg leg first, that would be a good tactic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what I
learned something about
if I had a peg
how leg. To enter a beach. It's always peg leg first.
Peg leg first.
Just in case there's a glue trap. I feel like the closest parallel for for Pirates of the Caribbean, it gets lumped in with shows like Black Sails sometimes, other pirate media. I think its closest relative is actually somewhere between Robin Hood, Men in Tights, and Game of Thrones.
Okay.
And like, that's the space it inhabits. And so to the extent that there is history in it, it's kind of broad strokes, inspiration, aesthetic, things like that, which honestly makes it a often more illuminating about historical reality than something that's trying really hard to get it right and just falls short for whatever reason.
Yeah, I mean, like a big part of it is like you can't really have like a fun summer blockbuster that has like too much historical honesty, because We don't want to think too much about what was probably being transported on those boats.
Yeah. I mean, how did that work out for The Last Duel and Ridley Scott? Good movie, not a summer blockbuster.
Not a summer blockbuster.
No.
You can't have slaving in your summer blockbuster.
Yeah.
No.
He nailed it with Master and Commander, and then he flew too close to the sun.
I mean, I think like I'm trying to think, is there an example of would you consider Gladiator a summer blockbuster that has slavery in it, but it also has slave revenge fantasy?
Yeah. And also it has the kind of slavery that doesn't bother us because it's too long ago.
True. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. If we had to think about racialized chattel slavery in the Atlantic world, that might hit too close to home.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like, yeah, probably the consequences of ancient Roman slavery have been resolved in a way that the consequences of the African slave trade have not.
Yeah, perhaps
true. I think that's probably quite a good way of putting it.
Yeah, not that those have any bearing on present day America, but of course not. None, zero. No, we live in an eternal present, no past here in this country.
Right, this is a... It's not just the end of history. This is the no history.
Yeah,
exactly.
That would be fun. The Goldfish Nation. I've got no idea who the last president was.
You laugh, but like there are millions of theoretically highly educated Americans who have essentially no idea what's happening beyond the end of their nose.
Yeah,
that's a whole mode of American political life.
No idea who the president was 3 months ago is the handshake meme between Goldfish and Joe Biden.
Yep. Yeah. I half of them would choose the Goldfish in that scenario.
You know what? I'm a Goldfish truther. I don't even think their memories are that bad. I think they're lazy. I think they remember. They just can't be bothered.
Well, they're not doing any chronicling. That's the thing. When you're a goldfish, like the days do kind of run into one. You swim in circles in the bowl. There's the little fake castle thing. You get fed, but there's not really anything to grab onto in terms of distinguishing one day's events from another.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look in the chronicles, then you're able to at least identify the castle.
Yeah. See, this is why. So what you're saying is the goldfish need an annalist tradition, like somebody to do annals.
Yes, that's right. That's what we're saying.
Yeah, that's
what I'm hearing from this conversation.
That's the formal position of the show.
Yeah, is that goldfish need to get to chronicling. Not just goldfish.
All domestic fish. Angelfish.
Yeah. Yeah. Beta fish. Yeah. Sure.
We need a sort of fishiest dio who can recount all of their using dubious source material.
Yeah, we need.
I'd read Great Goldfish of the Modern World. I'd read that book.
Yeah. Tetras.
Yeah. I wouldn't.
They
I
also
wouldn't.
Need to get. They need to get to the analytic tradition.
Yeah, I think so.
What are those? What are those like fun little fish that have like the big bug eyes? What are they called?
You're gonna need to be a little more specific. I think that describes a lot.
No, they've got like unusual bug eyes. They've got like they look like they've been put through a Snapchat filter.
Oh. I mean, I know what you're talking about, but I'm discovering that my knowledge of fish is actually pretty limited here.
They're like bulging.
Oh.
I find the whole category of creatures pretty unsettling, to be honest with you.
Yeah, fish. And the deeper you go in the ocean, the more fucked up they get.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
They're not friends.
Yeah, there's a certain depth below which there's no need for us to know about down there.
No, huh?
Well, I disagree. I think there should be chronicles for each level of the ocean.
No, when you get down below, they start doing narrative history. It's no longer chronicling.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, the sort of the gossip monger Salmontonius.
Yeah. we need the Livy of the Marianas Trench.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, you keep going down. There's a Thucydides all the way at the bottom.
Yeah.
Thucydides at the bottom. He's just lying on the ocean floor. He's one of those things that like sort of camouflage, so he looks like sand, and he's just like there going,
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. That would be great.
Yeah, and just and at the same time writing a masterpiece of history.
That's right. Thucydides.
Yeah. Yeah. Salacides, how about that?
Yeah. There we go. All right, should we talk about Pirates of the Caribbean? I'll tell you this for nothing. I fucking love this film. I love this film so much. The story doesn't really make sense. The main love story is fantastically unconvincing. Bloom is the worst actor I think who has maybe ever lived. He makes Jonathan Rhys-Meyers look like fucking Anthony Cher. I don't know what Kira is up to in this thing, but I love it so much. I've said this probably in public before. the ending, the final few minutes of Pirates of the Caribbean is my favorite ending of any film ever, to the extent that whenever I watch it, which I do frequently, I rewatch that bit 4 or 5 times because I like it so much. When I hear the swashbuckling music, which, it's so good, I am like hooting and hollering, like sitting on my haunches, like a baboon that's like a particular sports fan. That is how I respond to this film.
Nolan could learn a lot from the swashbuckling soundtrack.
Oh, couldn't he just? So could Jules Holland.
And we've got Captain Jack Sparrow.
Boogie woogie piano comes in. You put a donk on it. I would also like to observe before we get going that we are not like pretending that Depp is not a piece of shit. He's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
He's a piece of shit. I hate him. Fuck this guy. This film is like 20 years old. It's not an excuse, but you can just for the 2.5 hours of swashbuckling, just divide your brain into two and pretend that this is
a conscious
unbuckling. It's nothing to do with the scum sucking piece of shit that he actually is.
Yeah. Do as Joe would do and allow yourself to swash.
Yeah.
Also, a lot of great buckles in this movie.
So many great buckles.
Leaving aside the swashbuckling, a lot of great buckles.
We've got some lovely slouchy boots. We've got some lovely blouses. We've got the weirdest pronunciation of the word steel that anyone has ever done.
What's really striking to me after watching this again for probably the 17th time, I've seen this movie so many times because I also love this, is how fucking competent it is at every level. Yeah. Like, so to your point, Phoebe, like, yes, Orlando Bloom, god awful.
Oh, right?
Like, really, really not good at what should theoretically be his job of acting. With that said, he's perfectly cast.
Mm.
And the way the movie is done makes it so that he occupies a blank space of character that is designed almost purely to reflect the other characters, right? So because he's so bland and such like an archetype, he's literally just an archetype of the ingenue hero, right? Like he has no personality of his own, really. It allows him to perfectly reflect what makes the other characters more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's intentional. That like they got on set and they figured out, oh, this guy fucking sucks. What can we do with this? Because even an actor who sucks playing an uninteresting role can still be useful to the thing as a whole, right? Like if you use him correctly, and they do, because when they put him in dialogue with Jack Sparrow or Elizabeth Turner, who are much more interesting characters on every level, right? Like what is interesting about them and what stands out about them becomes very clear. And I love that. I love that he's in here to just be a fucking good-looking mirror. Like, that's his whole purpose in this movie, and he accomplishes it perfectly.
There you go. Just stand there and look pretty. Those were the director's instructions.
Mm.
Yep.
Yeah. You've also got Jonathan Pryce being Jonathan Pryce.
Oh, God.
Yeah, again, my God, man.
Just fucking rules. Just rules. Mm. Chewing the scenery, having a great time. Like, understands what movie he's in. Yep. Mm-hmm. So speaking of the wig, there's a scene toward the end when they're on the ship having the battle, and Jonathan Pryce has locked himself in the office and he's desperately trying to not get eaten by the zombie pirates. An arm reaches through the door and snatches off his wig, leaving him wigless, right? The next scene that we see him in, or the next shot of him, he has the wig on, which implies that at some point the character went and found a backup wig between those shots.
Yeah.
And that's entirely in keeping with the character that he plays. It's perfect. It's such a, like, I'm sure it's just a continuity error, but I'm imagining it as a real detail in this world. Yes, which makes me love it even.
Which is good news for the undead pirates, because let me tell you, when a British colonial governor takes his weave off, then you know he's about to beat your ass. That's when it's getting serious.
It's true. Yeah, it's but like the two are like Glorilla and a British colonial governor. If there's a weave coming off, those are the two. Yep.
Also,
in some order.
Also, honorable mention for me, a lot of mention of Davy Jones's locker, which I always enjoy because it evokes to me the time when Rebecca Vardy was defending herself in court. And basically to avoid, people might assume that this is disingenuous to avoid questioning on the contents of said phone. Her publicist's phone found its way into the sea, and her publicist claims that she accidentally dropped it over the side of a ferry. And the barrister's questioning Rebecca Vardy, and he refers to the phone and he goes, "Oh yes, of course, the phone, which is now in Davy Jones's locker." And she just goes, "What does that mean?" Or did she say who's that? It was one of the two.
Yeah, I think she said who's that. Yeah. She said who's that.
That's the great part about the Rebecca Vardy situation as a cultural touchstone is that there are so many hilarious layers to that.
Oh, yeah.
The whole situation is fucking hilarious. Like, everything about that is funny on some level.
The fact that she brought the court case herself and so was responsible for humiliating herself. Incredible.
Yes. Yeah, I really, really one of my favorite incidents. To our American listeners who may not be familiar with this, do yourself a favor and just Google Rebecca Vardy and follow the rabbit hole. You're going to have a great time. This is a great thing to do of an evening if you've got the time.
One of the funniest British celebrity court cases of all time, for sure.
Which is a high bar to clear.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there's a lot of really funny ones.
It's only rivaled for me by the non-celebrity, the criminal case brought against a man called Jonathan Chu, but like not Chu in a Chinese way, like chew your food. Who was arrested essentially for grabbing Chris Whitty, the head of like Public Health England, and just kind of like shaking him by the shoulders in a park and going, "Way, it's Chris Whitty," he was supposed to appear in court in person. He appeared by video link and said, "I have diagnosed coronavirus." And then he's wearing a dressing gown. And then he just starts yelling about how he demands to question Chris Whitty himself. And they're like, "You don't get to, this is, no, that's not how it works.
It's not this kind of thing."
And then his barrister quits on the spot because he's like, "This is too embarrassing." And then he starts vaping. And the prosecution barrister says, "Mr. Chu, your cavalier attitude to these proceedings is astounding." And he just says, "What does cavalier mean?" What? One of the greatest like two paragraphs of court transcript I've ever read in my life. Unbeatable.
Oh my god! That's Captain Jack Sparrow behavior.
Yeah.
My favorite British court case was there was a guy a little while ago who drove a tank to Wickes in a dispute about an unfinished kitchen and is now
literally parking his tax on Wickes's lawn.
Yeah.
In this case, their car park.
And the same guy, if you do a little bit of a deep dive, either went to prison or was certainly kind of prosecuted in some way for taking some kind of weapon to the house of somebody who he was having an internet fight with. And it's one of the earliest examples of somebody being prosecuted for a kind of internet
It was a meet me in Temecula type situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you look up the kind of the news reports of the time, it says that these two had a dispute having met on an anti-Islam message board.
Absolutely incredible.
Now that's the human pageant for you right there.
Oof. He's a great guy. His last name was Gibbons.
Gibbons. Yeah.
Obviously.
Perfect.
That tracks.
Perfect that tracks. Stuff.
Perfect.
It's such a long time since we've discussed something which I've really liked.
which is so enjoyable.
It's kind of hard, like to, I mean, like, because obviously, like I said, there are holes in this plot a fucking mile wide, but like it doesn't matter because remember when summer blockbusters, I said this to you guys in the chat, like when summer blockbusters were fun, when you didn't have to sit mm-hmm. through fucking 90 minutes of scene setting about a CIA torturer who wears a leotard and is like sad about being a torturer, and then the action doesn't start until like you're halfway through the film and you're like, I really should have gone to the toilet one more time before this started because we're locked in, we're in here for the fucking long haul. I should have gone back after the trailers and got some more snacks because now I've finished my snacks and I need to go to the bathroom. And basically nothing's happened. And I know that there's at least 2 hours left.
I have a metric for a summer blockbuster.
Okay.
And this is how it works. So I like processed meats. I'm a processed meat guy. Mm. I especially like hot dogs.
I'm a processed meat guy. I don't know what to tell you. I like processed meats. I'm a fan. I'm a connoisseur.
That's how you know they're safe, because they've been processed.
I'm trying like, out otherwise, they're not safe.
So I really like a hot dog, and I especially like to get a hot dog at the movies. That's every time I go to the movies, I get a hot dog.
Insane, but fun.
For a summer blockbuster, there needs to be some sort of compelling action scene by the time I'm done with my hot dog.
Okay.
If you are making me wait any longer than that, we are out of summer blockbuster territory, and you're doing something that is too highbrow to deserve the label.
And this man is done with his hot dog pretty quick. So Hollywood, if you're listening, bear that in mind.
Yeah. I'm not saying that they have to adhere strictly to my schedule, but it's a pretty good indicator if they do.
Yeah. Do you know what was a really dumb, fun movie that was made relatively recently that I enjoyed? I watched it on a plane. Bullet Train.
That was a dumb fun movie. I really liked that.
With Brad Pitt and Aaron Taylor Johnson. I was this movie is better than it has any right to be, despite having ostensibly no script.
And guess what? First action scene before I'm done with my hot dog.
Perfect. That's all we ask.
Fits the bill.
It's simple, that's all I want. It's simple to make a good movie. Well, don't make me come over there.
We should send you to Switzerland so that you could like design a very specific watch.
Yep. Oh, what's it that like tells you when the action scene should be?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. According to your hot dog eating.
Yeah.
This is the hilarious thing to me is studios are spending all of this money on AI shit now, right? Mm. And they're trying to write scripts using these AI tools to try to get the timing just right, to try to get the structure just right, to try to suit consumer desires. And really all you need is like a hefty guy who hasn't left his couch in 3 years
and a hot dog.
who loves a processed meat to tell you this stuff.
Yeah.
It's not like you don't need a billion-dollar AI model to tell you how to structure a summer blockbuster. You just need some slob who loves hot dogs who's seen every action movie.
Okay, I'm going to publish this. I'm going to publish this as a theory. This is how you test the pacing of your script. You sit Dr. Pat Wyman down on a sofa with six hot dogs in front of him, and every time he finishes a hot dog, something interesting has to have happened on screen.
Yeah, like you joke, but honestly, this is every bit as effective a thing as what studios are going to do, which is talk themselves into spending billions of dollars on these on these machine learning based tools to write scripts, when literally all you need is just like some asshole like me to sit there and be like, I'm fucking bored, man. Like, there's a time to rip the Benjamin again.
It's mad. It's mad as well. Cause like, I feel like someone should maybe like come up with a profession whose job it is to like come up with scripts. Someone should do that. Cause that, as far as I'm concerned, that doesn't exist, but someone should invent that profession. You know, someone whose job it is to come up with what the characters say and then kind of sketch it out in such a way that like it doesn't kind of drag, but it also doesn't rush. So you get the kind of the pacing, you get all the characters, like you like think about what the characters might say in any given situation. You come up with stuff for them to do. You come up with, you know, some peril.
Sounds like a big
job for one guy. It does. And like I said, that feels like that should be some kind of profession, but I don't think it is. So they really have no choice but to burn down the Amazon in order to continue making Marvel films. There's no choice. Mm.
The really funny thing to me is, like, you can churn out whatever kind of idiot slop you want to using these tools, but actually making something good requires a level of skill that is so far beyond the comprehension of the people who are going to make these tools. Like I know people who are actually good at this, right? Like I have friends who are TV writers. That's their job, or they write screenplays. Like, that is their job. And they are so much sharper about understanding the dynamics of how things translate from the page to film, of like rhythm and cadence and dialogue, like all the stuff that goes into this. Like, I write for a living. I'm a pretty decent writer by most standards. These people are miles beyond me, like miles beyond my level of skill.
A different skill set.
Yeah, but you would think that I would be at least able to comprehend how they do it, given a baseline level of understanding of how writing works. And it's still kind of mind-boggling to me.
Well, swashbuckled, Pat. You've been too focused on, the beaker people and the sea people and stuff.
Yeah.
This is one of several problems with my premise here.
Yeah,
yes.
An era in which there was very little swashbuckling.
Well, what they do is they get...
invented the swash or the buckle.
Or the buckle.
Yeah, even the sword, pretty new.
Yeah.
Well, what they do, Pat, I actually have some insight into this. What they do is they get several bags of Maltesers. Mm-hmm. And then when they get to the end of the bag of Maltesers, plot point.
Yeah. Yeah, that's nice. Right, should we do the plot?
Yeah.
Do we have to? Is it...
I just want to talk about how it rules.
Such as there is a plot. Yeah.
But okay, but the plot, such as it is, it is intentional, right? Like, it is intentionally, like, whatever you think of the beats of the plot or the content of the plot, it is masterfully structured such that it moves the movie along from one thing to the next.
It does, yeah.
Right? Like, there's, and all of the different subplots intersect very nicely. It's done very efficiently. There are not wasted scenes. There are a lot of scenes that fulfill multiple purposes. And so at like a basic level of putting the thing together, it is extremely competently done. It's really well edited too. Mm. Like when you look, they do a lot with single reaction shots, right? Like you get a lot of close-ups of actors' faces to tell you what they think of what just happened, which is it doing that well and getting the timing on it right is not that easy to do. So like, there's a level in which this is just like a well-made movie. Mm. Like, the people who were involved in making it were good at their jobs, which is, I like, that goes a long way.
It does.
Yeah.
I think it's got a pretty good script. Like, there are bits of it which basically anything which, like, poor old Elizabeth, who I think is an interesting character, and Keira Godlover does the best she can with some quite minimal material.
Despite her terrible taste in pirates,
for that matter.
Yeah.
There's a bit where she says, "I thought you might have been a pirate. That would have been awful." And you just think, that should have come out in the edit. That's not a good line. That's a poor line, poorly delivered. But then it's made up for by Captain Jack saying, "No survivors. And where do the stories come from, I wonder?" What a fucking good line.
Mm.
What a fucking
it's a great line.
It's a great line.
I should also point out, this film, budget of $140 million, box office of $654.3 million.
Cannot tell you how much of that $640 I was personally responsible for. I saw this film in
You've actually bankrupted. You'd be so rich if you hadn't rented Pirates of the Caribbean so many times.
I saw this film in the cinema like four times. I'm not even sorry.
Incredible.
This was the first movie that I ever illegally downloaded.
Oh, hell yeah.
That was right after I got to college, because it came out like 3 weeks before I started college.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I saw it twice in the theaters. And then when I got to college and they were like, "This is LimeWire."
Yes.
All right.
Oh,
off we go.
Boy.
Off we go.
.exe. And then it turns out like that. This is just a Deftones album.
Which I was also happy to get. I was also happy to get the Deftones album. But not exactly what I was looking for. I did get a cease and desist notice from the film studio about this one.
Amazing.
I did, yes. Yeah. It was sent to my dorm room. Very disturbing for an 18-year-old at that point. Speaking of competence. This movie is a masterclass in subverting expectations, subverting audience expectations. And part of the reason it feels so rich and developed, despite not doing an enormous amount of tedious world building, is because it knows that you, the viewer, have stereotypes of pirates and that you have stereotypes of heroes and you have stereotypes of villains. And it allows you
in distress as well.
And damsels in distress. And it plays with those repeatedly as a way of characterizing characters without actually having to spend a lot of time on it. Like the scene of Johnny Depp of Captain Jack Sparrow coming in on the crow's nest of the sinking boat is one of the most perfect things I've ever seen, because we're like, oh, a pirate, like on his glorious flagship. And then no, it's just a boat that is barely going to make it into harbor here. That is a way of playing with the stereotype of successful pirate. It's a way of introducing us to the character. And all of that happens in four shots. It's a really, really fast scene. And think about how much work that does for you, the viewer, to get you into the world, to introduce us to the character, to introduce us to the archetypes that we're going to see, without having to do a voiceover or something.
Mm. Yeah, it does feel like there's this thing where films from sort of 20 years ago or more, they don't have to be good movies in the sense of saying anything interesting or whatever, but just the sheer level of just Hollywood competency that's on display in terms of making a movie that's entertaining, that, is paced correctly, is shot well. And that it just feels like that you don't get as much of that now.
Mm. Oh, no, you really fucking don't.
There's an argument about this that basically because they have started to make so much more stuff, that the actual talent pool of people who know how to make stuff is not that different.
Yeah.
So there are still very, very people who are very, very good at all this stuff.
Mm.
It's just that the total proportion of work that is done to that level of competence is now so much lower that we're exposed to so much more stuff that just never would have seen the light of day. People who never would have gotten that job 30 years ago.
Yeah. Not everything can be Pirates of the Caribbean anymore. Yeah. I mean, you still see good movies, but it does feel like it's harder to go to the cinema and think oh, there'll be something on that I will enjoy. Like we watched Anora recently. That was great. That was fun. That had a kind of Uncut Gems energy, which was probably the last movie I'd enjoyed that much.
Speaking of competently done movies, Alex Garland's Civil War.
That was quite fun.
Yeah, I thought that was another movie that it was so competently done that audiences almost didn't know how to engage with it, because they're so used to having everything explained to them and having this explicit world building done, where audiences 20 years ago were maybe more used to having to figure things out for themselves. You could see now if Pirates of the Caribbean came out today, somebody would be mad that they didn't immediately know Captain Jack Sparrow's backstory. There's nobody telling us that this is Captain Jack Sparrow.
We need a Jack Sparrow montage. We need a freeze frame. Just Jack Sparrow.
Oh, fucking hell. You need somebody with a little klaxon every time something problematic happens in Pirates of the Caribbean. Just a little person pops up in the corner being like, "What? This is supposed to be bad."
The portrayal of the peg leg here is quite ableist.
You can't. It's hard to overstate how much times have changed since this movie came out and how much stuff is in here that you 100% couldn't have even gotten away with 5 years afterwards.
Good Charlotte were in the charts. It was a different time. It was a different time.
We were sure Avril Lavigne hadn't been replaced by an impersonator. That's how far back we have to go.
I think we were in an Avril Lavigne interstitial period, actually. This was,
Were we?
This was when she'd gone to ground. in order to be replaced.
Yeah. The Queen Mother had only recently died.
No, the Queen Mother died in like 1997.
No, she died in 2002. This is Mandela effect. Yeah.
Who am I thinking of that died in like the same week as Diana?
Yeah, Princess Diana? Yeah,
who died in the same week as Diana.
Yeah, so it's in March 2002.
Yeah. Wasn't that the year of the Jubilee?
Yeah. It was, yeah. 3 months before.
So maybe that was like the Queen's treat.
There's an article here. The Queen Mother's Fascinating Life in Pictures from Tatler, published 1 month ago. Why have Tatler chosen February 2025 as the time to discuss the Queen Mother's life? 23 years after her death.
That's strange, isn't it?
Intriguing.
I'd like to hear that pitch.
Yeah, yeah. I guess they have a lot of slow news weeks at Tatler. If not enough debutantes have had a birthday party or whatever. Not enough guys from Made in Chelsea have launched a nootropic supplement range or whatever the fuck it is they report on. Grouse shoot on Clarkson's farm, polo matches. If there's not enough of that going on, then they just have to do things like, remember the Queen Mother?
I can't overstate how much I'm enjoying the sheer level of contempt rolling off your tongue here. Like, that's for every single one of the, like, I didn't think that you could hate the concept of a grouse hunt more than you had already hated the concept of a nootropic supplement. Oh. And clearly there was somehow more venom. Like, you ramped it up. That was excellent work, Clemmy Milo. I just want you to know.
Has cancelled her summer drinks. It's absolutely fucked our July issue. You've got to run the Paul Burrell stuff again. I know.
Look, we've got a hole to fill. What can we do with the Queen Mother? That's where we're at here.
Exactly. Well, that is what they did with the Queen Mother. They filled a hole.
Oh, Jesus Christ, dude.
Ultimately, in March 2002, there was a hole to fill. And
it's funny because she's dead.
Yeah, that is right.
Yep.
That is right. You know what? 102 for someone who had a blood alcohol percentage of about 94 for her entire life. That's pretty good. I mean,
that's what kept her alive. She was basically pickled.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That is true. It has a preservative quality once you start getting up there. That's what we don't tell you about alcoholism. It's like, it's the midwit graph, you know, where it's bad is in the middle. Like, you can drink like very little alcohol, but if you drink loads, you push through the negative effects and you become kind of superhuman.
It's the same with it's like basically like any kind of substance abuse. Like, you do enough of it and you will literally never die. Like, Ronnie Wood is being literally physically held together by drugs.
Yeah.
Look at Keith Richards.
Well, exactly.
Man. Like,
yeah, the pair of them.
Is Keith Richards still with us?
Yeah.
This is.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Do you remember when he got hit on the head by a coconut?
No. Neither does he.
I'm pretty sure it was Keith Richards. He was like in like Barbados or somewhere, or the Bahamas, and a coconut fell on his head from a tree. And he was like in hospital. It was in the news.
I didn't know about that, but that's very funny.
I have to Google this now because I feel like I'm going insane.
He's still around. He's like 80 years old. And I mean, I would assume still blowing smoking, doing whatever.
I know he fell out of a coconut tree in Fiji in 2006 and made news for needing emergency surgery.
What was he doing?
Very funny.
And he was with Ronnie Wood. Him and Ronnie Wood were trying to climb the tree together. This is so funny because there's a Google AI summary of this. And it's like, what happened? Richards and fellow guitarist Ronnie Wood were trying to climb the tree. Next bullet point. Richards landed hard on his heels and hit his head on the trunk of the tree. Point three, he was taken to hospital in New Zealand and underwent brain surgery.
What? Totally worth it. Again, totally worth it to burn down the Amazon.
What,
for that.
But what was the media reaction, I hear you ask? Well, you'll be pleased to know Google has provided two bullet points. Media reports in Australia and New Zealand said Richards had been conked by coconuts, which is the most fucking antipodean headline I've ever read.
That's pretty far up.
So, like, was his encounter with the coconut tree, is that why Johnny Depp decided to do the impression of him for Captain Jack Sparrow?
Maybe. Also, wait, hang on a minute here. No, under what was the outcome? Brain surgeon Andrew Law became a constant companion to Richards and is now treated as a member of the family.
First of all,
huge eye opening up on my forehead here.
So we have got to message Andrew after this. We've got some questions for him.
And thank him for saving Keith Richards' life.
Yeah. Though, if we're going to be honest, Keith Richards probably would have been fine. Probably didn't need the surgery. Probably just would have kept right on going.
Just give him a line. He'll be fine.
Yeah, what's one more brain injury for Keith Richards?
Yeah, as spinach is to Popeye, cocaine is to Keith Richards. Exactly. Yeah,
that's where we're at. Yeah. No. So the Keith Richards impression predated the brain injury. That was one. Just Johnny Depp had just that was an inspiration for him. And I'm thinking Keith Richards' appearance in the third Pirates of the Caribbean movie. I think it's the third
one. Don't let him under that coconut tree.
Yeah, they're like, no, he's got a strict rider in his contract that stipulates no.
You have to get a special like baby gate to put around any tree, because otherwise Keith Richards sees it. He's like, I've got to climb it. I'm gonna windmilling his arms.
Yeah, one of those cages that they use in New York City for the trees.
Yeah, Andrew Law on set at all times in case Keith Richards gets hit by a falling coconut. Just
a brain surgeon on call.
Yeah,
honestly, not the worst idea if you've got Johnny Depp on your set.
No, he's probably another man who was certainly held together for a long time by substances.
Yeah, still is. See, now the problem with Charlie Sheen is that he has stopped the substances, and now look at it.
He's not got any juice anymore. You know, no tiger blood in those veins. We're not going to do the plot, I do have some questions about the plot.
Yes. Yeah. Let's hear it.
So the plot, as I understand it, right, is that you've got Keira Knightley, and she's like supposed to be the governor's daughter.
She's the governor's daughter.
She's the governor's daughter.
She's the governor.
It's really hard being the governor's daughter.
Because you have to wear a corset. Because women in London.
And you've got
breathe.
That's right. You've got Orlando Bloom, who is a blacksmith, but he's the son of this.
Yeah,
pirate,
but he doesn't know that.
From Days of Yore. Yeah. And then you've got, and he's in love with Keira Knightley. And then you've got Jack Sparrow, who's just kind of there.
Yeah.
He's a pirate. We open with this kind of Jack Sparrow confrontation, and then he sort of nearly escapes, but then he gets caught because he has a fight with Orlando Bloom, which delays him long enough for him to be caught by the Redcoats. And we get this whole thing about how Orlando Bloom's practices sword fighting for 3 hours every day in case he meets a pirate, which for a blacksmith seems like an insane training regimen.
It doesn't seem like a good use of his time.
No, so much more smithing
like,
you could
like,
get
just
done
like as a kind of cost benefit.
You're reaching the point of diminishing returns.
Yeah. And so they lock up Jack Sparrow, but the ghost ship, the Black Pearl, turns up, and it's sort of all the undead pirates come in and they start attacking the town, and they kidnap Keira Knightley. And she invokes the right of parley and goes and talks to the captain because she has this Aztec coin thing that they
which she took off Will because they met on the crossing from England. She rescues him from the water because he's been in a shipwreck. He's been sent away, but with a piece of this Aztec gold by his father before his father's death. Kira rescues him from the water and then takes the medallion because she thinks that it means that he was a pirate and she wants to protect him from being whatever it is that they do to pirates.
She doesn't want him to be outed as a pirate.
And also she thought it was shiny. So she has it
they're
looking for it and they know that it's on the island they know that it's in Port Royal because she falls off the walls of the city and the medallion which she wears all the time because it reminds her of Will, like does a kind of a woom 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 in the water, and that alerts the skeleton crew of the Black Pearl.
Yeah. They're like sharks. Yeah, they're like, they can detect gold in the water. Yeah.
And also it kind of makes a kind of wobble board noise. And they're very attracted to wobble boards. They're like pandas.
Like Rolf Harris.
Not like Rolf Harris. Importantly, not like Rolf Harris. We've got what
Well, not in any other respect, other than their love of the wobble board.
One danger that we're discussing in this film. We're not like it's not a kind of danger AGM that we're. And as far as I know, Harris didn't love the wobble board. He was the prisoner of the wobble board. That is exactly what I was going to say.
He made an
uncompetitive bargain with a hoofed stranger. And had no choice but to wobble the board.
Never trust a hoofed stranger. That's why you've got to make people take their shoes off before
Or get them to introduce themselves, and then they're not a stranger.
Yeah. So the problem with centers, as I understand it.
Yeah. They've got the wobble board behind their back. They're waiting.
They're waiting.
Erik Haaland, I want to see his feet.
Yeah.
I want to see his feet. I don't trust him. So, I don't trust that there's not more of him just continuing along the back. Like one of those
He does have kind of a horse.
Yeah,
haircut.
Like those like the bull anyway. Gate. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically then Jack Sparrow Will breaks him out of prison. And then they commandeer a ship and they start pursuing the undead pirates. And along the way they sort of pick up a crew and so on and so forth. And then it's revealed, right, that the pirates are they're cursed, right, because of this Aztec gold that they stole. And they have to return all the Aztec gold and like shed the blood of an innocent.
It's shed the blood of the person who removed the piece of gold. That's why it has to be Will. Or rather, they think that it's Elizabeth because she gives her name as Elizabeth Turner. So they think that she is the only child of Bootstrap Bill.
Right, yeah. So sorry, I did understand that. But as in, at this stage, I feel like they don't reveal that yet.
They don't reveal that, but it's not the blood of an innocent. They do say that the blood has to be repaid. So it's clear that it's part of the blood there. I did have one issue which I wanted to bring up about the specifics of the curse. There's two things about the specifics of the curse. One of which is you don't find out until the second film, I think, that Bootstrap has survived and he appears from like the bottom of the ocean. He's got like barnacles and shit on him.
Well, he's pulled himself up by his bootstraps.
He has.
From the bottom of the sea. Because that's what you did then.
He...
You know, there was no handouts in those days.
He's been spending his time down there chronicling with the fish, and he's come back up to the surface. Now, what should have happened is for the brief moment when the blood debt was repaid and all of the pirates become mortal, he should have drowned because he was at the bottom of the sea. Why hasn't he drowned? Yeah, why hasn't he drowned? My second issue is that the monkey, who is the pet monkey, is also a cursed monkey. I think that if you are the heathen gods placing a curse on the gold of the subjugated people, I think it's a bit weird to put in a kind of codicil saying, oh, and this includes monkeys. I think a curse will fall.
It's done on the basis of genetic similarity.
Yeah, a curse will fall upon anyone whomsoever removes a piece of gold from this chest. And then this like one heathen god being like, put monkeys too, men.
Well, it's pirates and
men
their dependents.
And monkeys.
You know, it works like a residential visa.
Well, if they hadn't named the monkey, perhaps it wouldn't have counted, but because they named the monkey Jack, he was fully a member of the crew.
Yeah.
The thing
is that the monkey is actually a stand-in for Robbie Williams, and that's why it's affected by anything that affects humans. And that's also why it sings Rock DJ at the end, which I admit was a confusing.
And also, presumably, by the time they've got the monkey's got a name, that probably means that he's on the ship's payroll. He's known to HR. He is a formalized member of the crew.
He's got a national insurance number.
Yeah.
He doesn't pay his national insurance.
No. So here's my real beef with the plot, right? Which is that. So they take Elizabeth to the place where they have to return the gold, right? They take her there, and Jack Sparrow and Will, they follow her there. And he returns the gold thing. And then earlier he said that he will have to kill her to lift the curse, right? And yet, all he does is he cuts her hand and lets some of her blood into the chest. And then they're all miffed that the curse isn't lifted. And they're all like, you must not be the person. And then it's revealed that it's Will, right? But, okay. He said he would have to kill her to lift the curse.
So why wouldn't their first thought be? He actually doesn't say that. He says there's no sense to be killing you yet because they still need her blood. He never specifies that. It has to be like all her blood, but they may as well kill her afterwards because she's not known to HR. She's not. She's not on the payroll of the payroll of the ship.
Okay, fine.
Hasn't paid a penny into the 401k.
I accept this, Socrates. Now listen to my next point, which is that being as that is the case, that they don't need to kill the person, when they're negotiating later with Will, why does he not simply say, well, just cut my hand and then everyone's, we can just do it and everyone, we can all have what we want.
It's because they're evil. Because they're evil pirates.
Because the one pirate with the really bad teeth says, we spill all the blood just to make sure. And apparently that was a very convincing argument, as opposed to Barbossa's.
Well, none of them are skilled debaters. This is one thing that I think has aged quite badly, which is that there are two black pirates and both of them are like substantially more frightening and evil than the other pirates. And I think that particularly the big bald guy who's always growling. I think it's a bit.
Okay. Plot questions are third. Jack Sparrow and Will, despite knowing that these pirates are immortal, continue to fight them at great length, getting absolutely even engaging in a naval battle with them before they try making them mortal, which to me is surely the first, like, there's no point fighting immortal pirates. Like, sooner or later you will lose, because no matter what you do, you can't kill them, but they can kill you. You're really onto a loser there as a strategy.
The fight scenes are so good, and they're holding them off. The naval battle is separate.
I was really confused by the naval battle. I was like, what's the aim here? Because by this point, we've established that they're immortal.
Also, remember, like, Will and Jack keep double. Actually, you know what? Will double crosses Jack, and then he is, if you ask me, kind of a dick about it. Because at one point, Jack is doing some fighting, and Elizabeth says, "Whose side is Jack on?" And Will says, oh, "At the moment, as if it's not possible to know." But like, Jack like goes out of his way to save Will. He's like, he's totally on his side. At no point does he double cross him. Will is the double crosser. Will's projecting.
So there's a really fascinating thing happening with these characters here, right? Because superficially, it appears that Captain Jack Sparrow has an arc, right? That he goes from being selfish pirate to being selfless and making sacrifices that benefit. Sure, they benefit him, but it's mostly for the benefit of his companions. Actually, not the case. He is Paddington Bear. Jack Sparrow does not change at all throughout the course of this movie. He is just himself, and it's Jack Sparrow's actions that alter everyone around him.
It's true. He says that explicitly. He says, "I'm untrustworthy, and you can always trust an untrustworthy person to be untrustworthy, but with a trustworthy person you never know when they're going to do something incredibly stupid." But this is all Jack's plan. As far as Will's concerned, Jack has given him up and is planning on leaving him to die. It's Jack's plan to turn them all mortal, and it has to be at the right moment, because so he takes a piece of the gold, which distracts Captain Barbossa, and it's a really cool bit when he kind of staggers into the moonlight.
Yeah, because this comes back to what we were talking about with competence, right? Like, to actually pull off a movie where your main character, because the main character is Captain Jack Sparrow. It is not the ingenue hero or the governor's daughter, the kind of inverted damsel in distress. That's not the main character. The main character is Captain Jack Sparrow. And to have a movie where your main character actually does not develop at all is surprisingly difficult, because in a standard movie, the A plot is based around the main character's development. It's based around their arc, their rise and fall, their fall and rise, whatever these happen to be, right? Captain Jack does not have that arc. Captain Jack has no arc. He has a plan, but he doesn't actually change in the movie. And it's all about the brilliance of the movie is that in exposing the other people around him to Captain Jack, they grow and change and become more, which is a surprisingly complex thing to do in a movie. that, and not at all, and shockingly much more complex than you would expect from what is essentially a summer blockbuster action, like light comedy action adventure film. That's actually a surprisingly difficult thing to do.
Yeah. And then we get Will rescuing him at the end. We get the full circle.
Oh, I love a rescue from an execution scene.
Captain Jack's presence has changed Will and allowed him to become who he truly is. This is
gay.
That is like again. It is. Yes. But it's definitely it's either the gayest thing or the straightest thing, and I don't know which one.
Often there's so much overlap between those two.
Yeah, those two things are not nearly as different as they
the
might
seem. The area where horseshoe theory really comes into play.
Yeah, pretty much. God, so one thing I want to talk about just a little bit, the extent to which this in any way, shape, or form reflects the reality of Caribbean pirates.
Mm.
And for the most part, no, it's got the place names, it's got ships, it's got flintlocks, it's got outfits. But the one thing that it does get right, and this is kind of stock, but also clearly they've done enough research to know this, is pirates really were a counterculture, not just like a subculture. They were a counterculture in the sense that they defined
like
themselves.
Emos.
They really did define themselves in opposition to the prevailing social and cultural mores of the time, quite explicitly so. And so to the extent that they get something right about pirates, that's a pretty important thing to get right, that they really were people who wanted nothing to do with organized society. They really were viewed as enemies. All of this is true. And if you get the fundamental dynamic of a time and place right, regardless of the details, it's going to tell you something interesting about that world.
Hmm.
And so I think it does that right. Like all credit where it's due for that.
Yeah, we do get a fun line where one of the Black Pearl crew mates says, "Oh, I curse to the gods whoever came up with the concept of parlay." And Jack Sparrow says, "That would be the French." Although I'm not sure that is strictly true. They came up with the word. But the pig French that the pirates love strikes me as something that probably actually doesn't emanate from the French. They keep saying savvy, which I'm enjoying.
It's perfect because they're like, these guys are all obviously dumbasses, right? Like there's a huge seam of dumbass culture that runs through this movie, which I greatly appreciate. Vein. Yeah, as an proponent of dumbass culture, I appreciate that I feel represented here. Like the big shirtless dude who's just like growling all the time. I'm like, that's my guy.
Yeah.
It's my man. I too am growling all the time. I'm often shirtless.
Representation matters, guys.
Yeah, it's the same way I feel
so
about
the thing
movie
is
Moana.
Like right at the start of the film, he's wearing a massive wig, and then he loses it. Yeah. And he loses it in a fight, but he doesn't have a backup wig. This is how colonialism was operating. The pirates did not have backup wigs.
It's true.
It's only the governors that have backup
wigs.
No, one wig.
Well, those wigs are expensive. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to Eden Ravenscroft.
I think that there should be a wig revival.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the party, the hair pieces, all of it.
I've read a couple of pieces lately about the comeback of wigs and how people are increasingly less attempting to hide it.
I mean,
less,
like big powdered wigs. I want to see.
I want to see men
wearing big powdered wigs, but with their normal clothes. That's what I want to see. Another thing that I think would probably not have made the cut. Because they're a bit like gamely try and do a kind of this is not your average damsel in distress, but like really she is a damsel in distress. Like she comes up with like one or two plans and she kind of spunkily at escapes the ship and so on, and she has the you like pain try wearing a corset line, which is it doesn't exactly make sense. It's more like she's practiced saying it. And she's like, you know what? Fuck this. I could wait forever. If I'm going to try and wait for the perfect time to say my little line about wearing a corset, I'm going to be waiting forever. So I'm just going to pretend that this guy said something that he didn't really say at all so that I can say my line about the corset. But there are two different occasions where she has to be like, so either like circumstances intervene or someone rescues her from being sexually assaulted by the pirates. And I feel like they might have left that out if they'd made this film now. Like, I think it's not really necessary. We know that the pirates are probably not especially respectful when it comes to sexual propriety. It doesn't need to be quite this explicit.
Yar, no one gave us a consent talk.
Well, this is the problem, because like pirate HR, they're spending all their time.
HR.
they're spending all the time trying to get the monkey to fill in the forms, but he just keeps shitting on them.
Yeah, he's really a thorn in their side.
Yep. So pirate ships, funnily enough, very strong HR traditions. The way pirate ships function, because pirate ships tended to have dramatically larger crews than merchant vessels of an equivalent size did. The pirate ship would have 3, 4, 5 times as many crew on a ship of the same size as a merchant vessel. That's a lot of people on a ship. Their cruises were usually pretty short because of that, because you just can't carry enough supplies. But that also meant that because there were so many people on board a ship, there were a lot of conflicts, right? So pirates developed a lot of mechanisms for how to diffuse that conflict and to find consensus. There were like institutional mechanisms for building consensus among the crew to make it so that you could have all of these people on a ship and then go, you know, kill and steal and do whatever it is that you're going to do. So pirates actually were big on HR and accountability, if not exactly
okay,
the concept
look,
of consent.
Right. So, right. It's time to do an accountability procedure, because you made me feel very unsafe when you asked me to scrub the decks. And that's something which I now need to escape that.
I'm holding that myself accountable, and I shall walk the plank if ye so wish.
But legit, this is the kind of stuff that happened on pirate ships all the time. Is captains couldn't be like, okay, everybody is doing this at this time. We're doing X, Y, and Z thing. And if you don't do it, there's a problem. No, they would just get voted out, or they would get marooned or tossed off the side of the ship. If pirates decided they didn't like their captain or they didn't like their officers,
joke about like, oh, like I thought the pirates code is guidelines. That's sort of like quite accurate.
Yeah, they had, it was pirate culture was a distinctly developed counterculture that had its own rules, mores, and even institutional mechanisms for enforcing.
That's so interesting. I did not know that.
Like, yeah, it was radically egalitarian in comparison to kind of prevailing trends. And there were, at best guess, probably 10 to 15,000 people who were active participants in this culture in the first couple decades of the 18th century.
I think one thing that doesn't actually make that much sense is why Elizabeth is so knowledgeable about pirates and the Pirates Code.
So that's it's a fun nod.
I mean, obviously we stan a neurodivergent. However,
yeah. Okay, yeah, she kind of is, and I'm here for it.
Yeah,
like she the hyperfixations. Not a lot of eye contact from her in this movie.
That's true.
Just throwing that out there.
I was trying to work up a bit about the radically egalitarian pirate society, but I was tying myself in knots, and what I kind of ended up with was like pirate Starmer, but from First Principles. Going, there's no I in pirate, but there is an I in pirate, but there's also a team in pirate, and there's no M in R. Yeah,
there's it, again rich veins,
centrist fence sitting among the pirates. That's what you want.
If I hear about any pillaging, so the Caribbean, like, I'm not going to be happy. But think on.
We only do pillaging now because of the Me Too movement. We've been looking back on our past practices, and we've been
you know
in the
what
wrong.
This is the problem. This is the problem. I am not happy with otherwise innocent pillagers being tarred like being tarred by that association, that there is surely many a pillager who's like, yeah, but like, I'm not a fucking danger.
I'm not a wrongin.
Like, I just pillage. Like,
well, I'm a danger to like livestock and fighting age like, men, but I'm not. Not a danger like, to women.
You know, don't put me in that. Don't put me in that category. Like, it, you're not. We don't necessarily go together. Like, I would really, really like it if it was not assumed that I was this kind of creep, because I just, you know what? Now I think about it, I am pretty sure that we've done this exact bit. We've done.
Oh. Say what you like about the Vikings. They just pillage. They go for the monks.
We have done.
They take the gold and they leave.
This exact bit with the bit about right down to the bit about the Vikings. Right down to the bit about the Vikings.
Congratulations.
So we come full circle.
in sum, the movie Pirates.
Oh my
of the
God,
Caribbean.
it's so much fun.
It's so good.
Can
I so good.
Just describe what happens in the last few minutes of the film? Just because I like it. Just
Please.
Because I like
yes,
it so much.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you're eminently capable of doing so.
Okay, so Elizabeth and Will get married. Commodore Norrington, who there's a bit when he's like, when he says like, oh, you know, I haven't yet achieved a marriage to a fine woman. You have become a fine woman. It's like, that's your dad's mate. That's gross. I know, but like, gross. He does, however, give Elizabeth up very graciously at the end. And he does this quite charming thing where he says, like, this is a beautiful sword. I expect the man who made it to show the same care and devotion in other aspects of his life. Which I think, I got to tell you, I think that's graceful and dignified. Fair play.
This is the Jack Sparrow effect. This is Jack Sparrow is Paddington Bear. He improves everyone around him.
Interesting.
Mm, yeah.
And is from Peru. Yeah.
That's my, yeah.
And Andy loves marmalade.
That doesn't come up very often, but
it's part of the lore.
It is
yeah.
canonically true.
And if there's one thing that pirates respect, it is a canon.
That's true. Jack's escaped. He's escaped the gallows. And he's back on the Black Pearl. And he's really excited to see his ship. He's just chilling out. He tells his sailors to go and, you know, go and get on.
Splice the
yeah,
name
go
braces,
and get on with their pirating duties. And he says, oh yeah, bring me that horizon. Then he starts humming the Pirate's Life for Me song. And then he pulls down the wheel and he says, drink up me heart is yo ho. He snaps shut the compass and that's it. That's the end. It goes black. It's like the end of The Sopranos. It's so fucking good. It's like proper kind of like whoop and holler. Do it again. Say drink up my heart is your hoe. Like the kind of it's snapping. Fuck.
Again, a thing that would never happen in a movie today where they would immediately be setting up sequel or the franchise. Mm. Instead, this movie just stops.
Yeah,
it is a completed thing.
There isn't an end of credit scene where you're like, who the fuck is that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no like, you know, wider universe characters they need to crowbar in.
Drink up, me hearties, yo-ho, snap. Game over.
This is my most curmudgeonly opinion about this movie is that they really did just make these things better a couple of decades ago.
Yeah.
I don't know that you could assemble the competence necessary to make this movie today.
They don't make a swashbuckler movie.
Oh, they
movie
really,
like that
really
these days.
Don't.
I tell you what, that were built
that were
to last.
Indeed built.
That were the first movie. I tell you what, I had a DVD copy of Pirates of the Caribbean: Curse of the Black Pearl, and it lasted me. It lasted me until 2019, and even then, only had to get rid of it because I went digital. But you know, these days, imagine getting.
I let the hem down something like that. On my DVD of Pirates of the Caribbean 4 times. I took it to the cobbler. That's what we did in those days.
they're resoling my DVD copy of Pirates of the Caribbean.
Good as new.
You look after one of those, right? You'll
I'm
have
just
it
trying
for
to
life.
Think if I had any other notes. Oh yeah, this was a really interesting period of filmmaking because this was a period of really really virulent anti-Cockney propaganda. So you got your pirates, you got your bad pirates, you got your orcs. I mean, that's it, actually, now I think about it. but like Snatch.
Also Snatch.
Bad Cockneys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This was the Guy Ritchie the good renaissance. Guys in that?
Well, Guy Ritchie is he's a fetishizer, if we're honest. He likes to exoticize the Cockney.
To put it in Kendrick Lamar terms.
Yeah, he has like a bit of a thing for the Cockneys, and he feels like the Cockneys should be grateful for his fetishizing projection.
Much like Quentin Tarantino and Feet.
Like Quentin Tarantino and
Feet. Yeah. It's terrible for the Feet community what Tarantino's done, you know.
On that note.
Yeah.
Do you feel like we've mined this vein?
I think we've mined it. We had a good time.
This was really
like I said, we're not gonna come up with a good reason why we chose to watch Pirates of the Caribbean. But
because it's fucking cool. It's fun.
Yeah, I tell you what, Pat came up with some impressive historical analysis to justify it. That I was not expecting to have that in the locker, Davy Jones's or otherwise.
Yeah, dude, I read a bunch of books on it. I love pirates. I'm fascinated by them. It's a wonderful phenomenon
in it as well. Because as you know, I believe has come up on the show before. Mm. I am a compass truther. When people say, oh, it points north. Mm. I don't know what that means. I don't know how you find, points north. I don't know how you find anything else. And what's more, I don't care to. So when I see a compass that doesn't point north, I'm into it.
Mm. That's how I feel about computers. Same deal. Don't know how they work. Just like, I'm going to take your word for it. Like, sure. All right. Okay. You tell me you can get us there. I believe you. I don't know how the thing works. I understand there's a magnet involved at some point. Like, all right.
As is my understanding.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Something to do with the North
Honestly,
Pole. I don't know.
If I opened up a computer and there was like, and there genuinely were just like kind of little creatures like carrying out whatever I needed them to carry out, I would not be especially surprised if that's how they work. They're all just hollow. No. Your chip board, so on and so forth. That's just for show. That's just
a bunch of undead
just
monkeys.
A bunch of frivolity.
It wouldn't actually change anything for the vast majority of us.
No.
We would go right on with our lives.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what's in there. None of your business. Like the bottom of the sea.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I'm on board with that. We're starting a new show next week.
Yes.
Yes.
And.
Yes.
And
Barbarians.
We are going to drink up me hearties. Yo ho. Snap. Snap.
Yo ho.
And really bad eggs.
So from our family to yours. Yo ho,
a hearty yo ho.
Also, we have a Patreon. You can subscribe to it. This has been a free one, but there's a bunch more shit like this all over the Patreon. So consider that.
Get that. Shit.
Get the shit.
Get on it.
Get the shit. Do it. Lock it in.
Yo ho.
Bye everyone. Bye.
Bye.